Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How often have you heard this? It's not the crime, it's the cover-up. The first criminal charges in the BP oil spill were filed today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, April 24th. I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us. 2 years and 4 days after the Deepwater Horizon exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, the Justice Department filed the first criminal charges in that case today. A former BP engineer has been arrested and charged with obstruction of justice. Prosecutors claim he intentionally deleted more than 300 text messages, messages that said BP's attempt to control the spill were failing and that more oil was leaking than what the company was telling anybody. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has the story.
Kurt Mix is accused of sending a text message that 15,000 barrels of oil were leaking daily from the BP well. It's triple what the company said publicly. Serious charge, but BP stock didn't do much on the news. It's relatively small news for company liability, says Pavel Molchanov at Raymond James.
He is accused in his own personal capacity of allegedly deleting these emails that he was instructed by the Justice Department to retain. There's no suggestion that he was told by his supervisor or senior management to do that.
But criminal charges may go up the ladder. Law professor David Ullman at the University of Michigan notes the Justice Department suggested more may come, but he's puzzled why the government is not yet going after BP, the company itself, and its partners.
The government has a slam-dunk criminal case against BP, Transocean, and Halliburton for the negligence that caused the Gulf oil spill. They should bring those criminal charges.
That, he says, is where the real money is, the actual explosion and the spill, not the cover-up.
Each of the companies involved faces billions of dollars in potential criminal penalties. In contrast, the penalties for obstruction of justice are much smaller.
By one estimate, BP's paid out some $20 billion in compensation, settlement, and cleanup. If the company, not just Kurt Mix, is found liable for criminal gross negligence, that could double the tab. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
As Scott said, BP shares barely budged in New York trading today. In Europe, meanwhile, most major stock indices recovered slightly after yesterday's sharp sell-off. The reasons for that sell-off, however, remain. Concern that once again, Europe is losing its grip on the debt crisis over there. Political events over the past couple of days in France and in the Netherlands in particular are the proximate cause. The worry goes something like this, that voters are pushing back against the key part of European deficit reduction plans, austerity. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The irony is almost perfect. The Dutch government has collapsed after failing to impose a new raft of austerity measures. And yet, says analyst Simon Tilford, no other country apart from Germany has been more critical of Greece's fiscal indiscipline.
The Dutch, for the last year, have been one of the leading cheerleaders for ever greater cuts in public spending in the south of the Eurozone. And they now find themselves unable to meet their targets.
Eurozone deficit cutting suffered another setback. French President Nicolas Sarkozy lost the first round of the presidential elections to socialist François Hollande, an anti-austerity candidate. If Sarkozy loses the second round in 2 weeks' time, it'll be a blow against the whole policy of belt-tightening championed by Germany. And, says currency strategist Steve Barrow, it'll damage the key European partnership.
That relationship between France and Germany, which has generally been close, that relationship could get very frosty.
Relations between Germany and many of the people across Europe are already frosty, so says Nigel Farage, head of the UK Independence Party, which campaigns against British membership of the European Union.
People do not want to live under German-dominated austerity, and we're seeing a democratic rebellion.
Germany says austerity is essential to reduce the Eurozone's debt load, but the backlash is growing. In 2 weeks, the Greeks go to the polls. Emboldened by the Dutch and the French, the Greeks now seem likely to vote for an anti-austerity government. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a split decision, two up, one down. Details, numbers, when we get there. Two items now from the immigration files. First, a report from the Pew Hispanic Center this week that the long wave of Mexican immigration to the United States has slowed sharply. Pew says the net inflow, that is, the number of Mexicans entering this country, was just about balanced out over the past couple of years by the number of Mexicans leaving. That's still not likely to shift attention away from undocumented immigration, which brings us to item two. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court of the United States takes up Arizona's tough immigration law and the question of whether states get to have a say in what has traditionally been federal turf. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more on that story.
The debate over state immigration laws often focuses on civil rights, but more and more economics is center stage.
I think what's new and interesting is that business leaders are increasingly speaking out against these laws.
Cecilia Wang is director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. She says Mississippi flirted with its own immigration bill.
The bill was effectively killed because the Mississippi Economic Council, which is the state chamber of commerce, stepped forward and publicly opposed the law.
But what about the economic interests of taxpayers in states like Arizona? Bob Dane is spokesman for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which advocates for a tighter border.
Illegal immigration cost Arizona taxpayers about $2.5 billion year after year.
Dane is skeptical of farmers who complain that tough immigration laws make it hard to find labor.
The great myth is that there are jobs that Americans won't do, and that is simply said by big business looking for the lowest possible wage to pay workers, and that's typically illegal aliens.
Farmers in Georgia pay up to $16 an hour, but can't get locals to take the jobs. So says Brian Tolar, president of the Georgia Agribusiness Council. Last season, he says Georgia's immigration law scared away foreign farm workers, leaving crops rotting in the fields.
If we don't have the labor, then we can't produce Georgia-grown, we can't produce U.S.-grown. We'll be importing all that stuff from outside the country, and I really don't think Americans want that.
Cecilia Wang with the ACLU says the Supreme Court needs to consider
whether we want to tolerate a system in which every state can pass its own immigration laws. That creates a patchwork of clashing rules so that businesses and ordinary people have to figure out what rules apply when they move from one state to another.
The Supreme Court's decision is expected in June. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Try though it might, the Chinese government is having a tough time controlling the biggest political scandal in that country in decades, the downfall of a charismatic and now former Communist Party chief from the city of Chongqing named Bo Xilai. He was cashiered more than a week ago for what are being called serious violations of discipline, basic stuff like corruption, all the way up to and including his wife's alleged involvement with the murder of a British businessman. It's a textbook example of the kind of disruptive scandal China's party chiefs would rather avoid in the name of economic harmony. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz is on the line to discuss. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So this story has literally everything. Wealth, yes. Money, power, intrigue, corruption. Make it make sense, though. Why does this story matter to us?
Well, it matters to us because this really is an existential problem for the Communist Party of China. You know, Bo Xilai was this very interesting, flamboyant politician who ruled a very blue-collar, enormous city in the middle of China, Chongqing. Mm-hmm. And he had this sort of, he was good-looking, charismatic. He had all these interesting policies that was different from what everyone else was doing. And he and his wife were often called the Kennedys of China. Hmm. And so this posed kind of an interesting problem for the current leadership of China, because he was definitely on his way into a leadership position.
You know, it's interesting because I was out there in Chongqing, a year ago now, I guess. And there was this cult of personality around this guy. He was on all the billboards. He was his big, you know, Five Reds campaign, this whole thing about, you know, going back to China's past. It was all over there. And now it has come crashing down.
Right. He sort of reminded you probably and other people of someone else in China's past. That would be Mao. And as you well know, Mao was not a great economic mind. He destroyed China's economy with a lot of his campaigns. The Cultural Revolution pretty much put China's economy at a standstill. So I think this sort of made a lot of people scared among China's leadership of what this guy could possibly do once he got real power.
What happens now as this thing plays out? He's obviously not going to be in the leadership. But the thing is that Chongqing is not a small city, right? There's 35, 40 million people out there. And my guess would be he's still probably pretty popular.
And that's the challenge for the party right now. He is popular. You know, you look at Chongqing. Chongqing is sort of like a combination of all of America's blue-collar cities put together.
Yeah,
if you took Detroit, Chicago, any in the Rust Belt, it's a very enormous, it's like the size of a New England state. So you've got a lot of the folks who really kind of formed the proletariat in old communist China. And so I think that right now China and the leadership in China has a very difficult challenge ahead of itself. It needs to convince folks that Bo was doing all of this for his own self-promotion, that he didn't care about the people. And I think that for some folks, it's going to be difficult because Bo has spent the last recent years grabbing for that nostalgia that a lot of workers in China still have for that yesteryear period of communist lore.
Yeah, which is always interesting to realize when you go there, that there is this nostalgia.
Right.
Frame this for me, though, Rob, in the context of China's future. Was it really a question of, do you go backwards with Bo Xilai and forward with the current leadership? I mean, what happens now?
Well, I think, you know, we're at a point where, you know, for the last 10 years, we've had this guy in power, Hu Jintao, who's been he's a really boring guy. But that's a good thing for China. You know, they've had for so many years, they had Mao, who was not boring at all, but was, you know, like I said, was pretty tumultuous for the country. And in some ways, having boring leaders in China has helped create a stable economy.
Yeah. Rob Schmitz, our Shanghai bureau chief. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.5% today, 74 points, closed at 13,001. The NASDAQ dipped 0.3%, that's 8 points, 29.61 at the bell. The S&P 500 put on 0.3%, 5 points, finished at 1371. After yesterday's drubbing, financial stocks refound their footing today. Morgan Stanley regained 2.5%. Goldman Sachs brought in more than 2% today. JP Morgan Chase added 1%. Citigroup banked about 0.5% today. Among the blue chips, AT&T dialed up more than 3.5% after reporting higher than expected quarterly profits. 3M posted a gain of about 1.5%. IBM, the world's biggest computer services provider, gained 0.7% after boosting its stock buyback plan. Apple was down during regular trading, but after issuing another blowout earnings report, the stock zoomed up more than 4% after hours. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve wraps a two-day meeting on interest rates and the economy. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for March. That's stuff like appliances, computers, and car parts. And it's World Malaria Day, recognizing the global effort to control the disease. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Shares of Walmart lost another 3% or so today. That's another $3.5 billion, plus or minus, from its total market value on concerns that a Mexican bribery investigation could end up costing the company a ton more than just $3.5 billion. The New York Times reported over the weekend that Walmart bribed Mexican officials as it built its business down there. We sent Marketplace's Adrian Hill off today to find out what impact those allegations might actually wind up having.
It's a little early to know what exactly the scandal will mean for Walmart.
We are in the top of the first inning here.
Peter Hinning teaches white-collar crime at Wayne State University. But he says even this early on, one thing is clear.
the company is going to be incurring enormous costs for an internal investigation. Those kind of costs can run into the millions and perhaps even as much as $100 million.
And if Walmart did, in fact, bribe people, there will be government fines.
It's not unprecedented by any means to see fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
$100 million here, hundreds of millions there, it adds up. Andrew Spalding teaches anti-corruption law at IIT Chicago Kent College of Law. He says the scandal could help Walmart's opponents block the company's expansion into new markets. It'll be harder for Walmart to make the case it's ethical. And sorry, implicated Walmart execs, but you might want to get that resume together.
I can't help but think that if Walmart really does want to maintain its the image that it's refashioning for itself, it's going to have to take some fairly dire personnel actions.
But there is one part of the company's business that's unlikely to change. Ken Perkins is an analyst at Retail Metrics.
The core consumer that goes to Walmart and is looking for value and low price is going to be virtually unaffected by this news.
Because when you're shopping for a cheap T-shirt or Oreos or a new garden hose, potential foreign corruption violations, they don't really register. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
All right, here's a marketing conundrum for everybody's inner CEO. Your consumer products company has a new item, something that's not part of most people's personal care routine. So first, you have to tell people what this new product is and what it does. And then you have to convince people they need it, even though it's a little bit, embarrassing. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has a real-life example.
Okay, I'm just going to get this over with. Cottonelle Fresh Care is basically a baby wipe for adults. Consumer products giant Kimberly-Clark is trying to get customers to use these wet wipes in tandem with regular toilet paper. Kind of a 1-2 approach. This isn't easy to advertise.
I say this and this is called Southern hospitality.
I call it the clean getaway.
But it is kind of an awkward subject, so it doesn't.
William Ward is a social media professor at Syracuse University. He says to handle the ick factor, Cottonelle is holding a contest on Facebook to give a name to the routine. So far, suggestions range from the tushies to the two-handed tango. Ward says the contest is a smart move.
If somebody has a silly name that they come up for it and then they share it to those friends, now you've just reached a new audience.
Billy Holkauer is a media analyst with Mintel.
Bathroom humor is enormously appealing. Maybe that's a better tactic than trying to explain why to use it in the first place.
Wet wipes account for about 3% of toilet paper sales in the U.S. And if Cottonelle can get people to double up on their TP purchases, it could do wonders for its bottom line. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I'm just going to move right along here. You know how businesses always say what they want most from the government is stability, some kind of certainty about things? All right, so think about healthcare right now. You can't get much more uncertain than waiting for the Supreme Court to decide what's going on, decide which parts of the healthcare law to let stand, if any, and which parts to strike down, if any. Doctors who've been practicing medicine the same way for decades are facing a whole new way of doing business. They just don't know what that way is. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports now from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia.
John Henry Pfifferling knows how stressful it can get. As director of the Center for Professional Well-Being in Durham, North Carolina, Dr. Pfifferling gets called in as a consultant to deal with doctors, nurses, even healthcare CEOs who've become unhinged.
They throw a forceps, or they push somebody out of the way, or they scream at somebody, or they curse at somebody.
In his 4 decades of doing this work, Dr. Pfifferling says he's never seen as many senior-level people acting out.
We don't teach people very well how to deal with uncertainty, especially our docs. We don't give them change mastery tools.
And these are times of change. In the industry, everyone seems to be trying on new hats. You have generic drug makers buying brands, nonprofit hospitals starting venture capital firms, even for-profit hospitals launching insurance networks.
You're seeing insurance companies buying hospitals. This is chaos.
David Nash is dean of the School of Population Health at Jefferson University in Philadelphia.
We're pouring more money into this system than any country on the planet. We know it can't continue. And then we have additional uncertainty about the Supreme Court decision.
And for doctors, it's not just the yay or nay at the Supreme Court or even the larger mandates of healthcare reform. It's how are they going to do business in the future? Richard Lofgren is chief medical officer at the University Health System Consortium.
the current anxiety that you're getting is that they have to have a foot on both stools.
One stool is the old way, where doctors fight for their piece of the pie and there's a fee for every service. The other is trying out new models of coordinated care and lower costs.
But there's uncertainty about which of those models are going to succeed.
There is tremendous anxiety, tremendous flux.
Toby Cosgrove is CEO at the Cleveland Clinic.
This is probably the biggest inflection point that we've seen in healthcare in the last 50 years.
And if Cosgrove seems like, well, the last guy who's going to fling a forceps at anyone, it's in part because he was a surgeon on the front lines of Vietnam. In part because at Cleveland Clinic, they already tackled the which way to go issue a long time ago. At the Cleveland Clinic and other hospitals like it, doctors earn a salary and they work in teams. The motto is to act as a unit, which is exactly the advice that the anti-stress guy, Dr. Pfifferling, gives his disruptive doctors. First, he tells them, give up the need to control everything.
It used to be that there was much less knowledge, less quality assurance, less scrutiny, less accountability.
A doctor could be a lone wolf.
That goal of mastery is basically impossible, given the explosion of everything we know. And the way to get a handle on it is teamwork.
Learn to trust your nurses, he says. Confide in colleagues. And above all, admit what you don't know. Before long, he says, this time of uncertainty might start seeming like opportunity. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Success in your chosen profession, really big success that comes fast, can make for a great story. All too often, though, it's a cautionary tale as well when followed by a precipitous fall from grace. Author Douglas Kennedy tells his version of that tale in his novel Temptation. It's a semi-autobiographical story about a screenwriter named David Armitage who hits it big with a TV series and then makes some short-sighted decisions. The paperback version of Temptation is out today. Douglas Kennedy, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Why did you want to write this story of rags to riches to I won't give away the ending?
When I was starting to write Temptation, I was thinking, what happens when success comes your way and you can't hold on to it? In 1996, a novel of mine, The Big Picture, had a huge auction in New York. I was paid an enormous amount of money. It was sort of greeted as the second coming of Christ. And the book came out. Wonderful reviews. Didn't do very well. After a second novel, which didn't do very well, I was shut out of New York publishing for about 9 years. Meanwhile, my career jumped in Europe. So that was the impetus for the book. The other thing was I'm a writer who's had 10 novels published. 3 of them have been filmed. So I was also very interested in the dynamic of Hollywood and in the fact that, as David Mamet once said, and I think this is a paraphrase, writing for the movies is like the beginning of a love affair. It's full of surprises, and you're always getting screwed.
let me back you up for just a little bit and ask you about that line you had about how you can't hold on to success. Does trying to hold on to success mean you can't? You know what I mean? Don't you have to just be with it?
I think you do have to be with it. I think, you know, success is something we all strive for. Once you have it, then what? That's the kind of interesting kind of moral question behind the book. Then what happens?
This idea in the book that David Armitage writes a television series that takes off, of course, brings to mind Matthew Weiner of Mad Men. It brings to mind Aaron Sorkin of The West Wing, whose work everybody loves or millions of people love, but who are literally one in a bajillion. Because you guys, writers, you say this yourself. You're like spare tires out there. You're just all over the place.
Well, that's what David says at one point. A writer is like the spare tire. And, you know, basically, you know, if a producer decides this tire doesn't work, well, he can throw out and get another tire. I think it was Jack Warner who, back in the golden days of Hollywood, called writers schmucks with Remingtons.
And there's typewriters, yeah, not the guns, but anyway.
Not the guns, no. And fundamentally, there's always that. I consider myself profoundly lucky.
You are what I will politely call a seasoned writer. You've been around for a while, right? Which means you probably have young writers coming to you saying, how do I do what you did? How do I have that success? And other than write better, what do you tell them?
I say 3 things always. Do you like being by yourself? And I'm not just talking physically, but actually existentially. Can you deal with being by yourself? Secondly, how well do you cope with disappointment and rejection? Because there's going to be a lot of it. And thirdly, do you have 20 years? Because even if the first book hits, there's going to be another one afterwards.
Douglas Kennedy, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the first thing about which you need to know is that milk does not transmit mad cow disease. That said, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced today that it's found a dairy cow in California that's been infected with bovine spongiform encephalopathy. It's the fourth such cow found in the U.S. food chain in the past 9 years. The Ag Department says there's no reason consumers ought to worry, but markets, as you know, don't mess around with this kind of stuff. Cattle futures in Chicago traded down today as far as they're allowed to go, even on the rumor of that news, let alone confirmation. All right, we got to go right now. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 74 points, about 0.5%, ended at 13,001. The NASDAQ dipped 8 points, 0.3%, 29.61. The S&P 500 put on 5 points, 0.3%. Closed at 1371. Thanks to Justin Ho and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.